You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
It isn't always clear to these leaders. They are conflicted down to the minute they step up to the mic.
King didn't want to tell him about the dream. John Lewis wanted to tell him about the nightmare. And if each of them had had their way, it would have been a very, very different march.
Well, hey, everybody. Welcome back to Fill in the Blanks. This is going to be a really interesting day for you. I have to tell you, it is interesting for me, and I haven't even started it yet. I'm saying that because my guest today is Jeffrey Nussbaum. Now, I'm going to tell you, this guy is an interesting, interesting man with an interesting, interesting history and job. He's written a book called Undelivered. It talks about the never-heard speeches that would have rewritten history. Think about this. How many times have people planned a certain outcome that never took place? They thought they were going to win an election. They thought a certain outcome was going to come to pass, and then it didn't. Or they had two different speeches written. They gave one, not the other. What Jeff has done is a compilation and an analysis of this whole history. Some of these things are really amazing, and the story behind them is great. And he's not just somebody that's collected these. He is a speechwriter. He was a partner at West Wing Writers, the premier strategy and speechwriting shop in Washington, D.C. And if you didn't know, there are these kind of places, just like there are for songwriters. He has worked in writing serious speeches. He's worked in writing humor. He's been involved in speech writing and messaging operations for conventions 2008, 2012, 2016, 2020. In coming up with our presidential nominees, he's served as Vice President Joe Biden's speechwriter on the first Obama-Biden campaign. He's written for Al Gore. He's been a collaborator with James Carville for the bestseller Had Enough. He's worked with Senator Bob Graham. I could just go on forever and ever, but I don't want to have you keep listening to me because I want to introduce you to Jeff. So, Jeff, welcome to Fill in the Blanks.
It's great to be with you, Dr. Phil.
What an amazing idea you had for Undelivered. What made you decide to do this?
So even though the book isn't political, I was a speechwriter for Al Gore on the election of 2000. So election night 2000, Al Gore prepares three speeches, not two, a victory, a concession, and then strangely enough, we thought he might win the Electoral College and lose the popular vote. So three speeches prepared. Those folks who are old enough to remember election 2000, Florida stayed too close to call too late. Gore gave no speech that night. And so all three of those speeches are lost to history. In fact, I was holding them at one point. I lost them all. So those aren't in the book, but it set me on this journey. What are the other moments, as you said in the introduction, not just in politics, but in issues of war and peace, leaders making different decisions where things were so close that there was a draft prepared for an alternate outcome. And so I started finding these in all sorts of different places.
Well, you have, and we'll talk about some of those in a minute. And I'm going to ask you some questions that go beyond the book. I've been waiting a long time to talk to you because this idea of speech writing is really intriguing to me. I don't know if you know, but I've spent a lot of time in the litigation arena as a trial scientist. And one of the things that we did was prepare witnesses. We prepared them to tell the truth effectively. And I've often said I'd rather have a poor set of facts presented really well than a great set of facts presented really poorly. I think there's huge power in linguistics. I think there's huge power in language. And writing speeches and helping people, not putting words in their mouth, but it's helping them get their thoughts out in an effective way. So I'm intrigued by what you do. When you write a speech for someone, you don't feel like you're substituting your thoughts or judgments for their own, but how do you describe what you're doing when you're writing a speech for someone else?
Yeah, first of all, you and I are absolutely singing from the same hymnal. We sometimes joke in speech writing that it's not the best product that wins, it's the best explainer. And that really is. It's about telling the truth effectively. It's about getting people to feel. And to answer the question directly, there are some people out there who say, I'm going to write the most brilliant speech I can write, and I'm going to find someone who's going to read it word for word. But that's not really how I've seen my job in politics and in helping business leaders. I really want to help them be their best self. And the way to do that is to really figure out not just how someone sounds, you know, how are you going to make it sound like me? And I say, well, that's actually the second question. The first question is, how do I make it think like you? How do you make an argument? How do you approach the world? And so I try to help the folks I work with, again, as I said, be their best selves, be their most persuasive, as opposed to be some external ideal of what a good speech is.
In order to do that, you have to really know that person's value system, right? You've got to sit down with them and say, okay, what is it you want to get across? What is it you want people to come away with at the end of hearing your remarks, hearing your speech? Do you start with the objective and work backwards from that? How do you go about it?
Yeah, I do. As a matter of fact, I go through this little exercise where I write at the top of the page, what is the dream headline coming out of this? What do I want the audience to take away? And then I sort of write to that goal. Because if at the end of hearing a speech, the audience doesn't take away what the speaker wants them to take away, that's a fail. That's a fail. So I start with the end objective in mind. And then I remember that the goal of a speech is persuasion. And how do you persuade people? And the saying is, you know, how do you move an audience to action or allegiance? And so we think, what levers do we need to pull? What stories do we need to tell? What facts do we need to deploy to get that audience to join you? Or if they've already joined you, to start marching.
I hear people all the time say politics are local. And I always say, no, I disagree. I think politics are personal. And they may not want to admit it, but I think at some point in the process, they say, what's in this for me and my family? What does this mean for my ability to provide for my children, my future? That doesn't mean that they don't care about other people, but at some point, it comes home to, do I really believe this? Do I really care about this? Does this person think and feel about the things that I think and feel about as well? And that takes telling a story.
Absolutely. And not to turn this into like a class on antiquity, this is what Aristotle called ethos. People think ethos means ethics, but it really means characterization. It means, is this person I'm hearing from someone I trust, someone who connects with me, someone who I believe will follow through, or at least is a worthy messenger that's deserving of my time and attention and maybe even support? So I agree, absolutely.
You talk in the book, and this is kind of getting out of order, but if you can help me with this, You talk about the five elements that are found in every persuasive speech. Can you talk about at least a few of those that you think are critical?
Sure, absolutely. And this I tell everyone, is my writer's block cure. So for all of your listeners and viewers who suffer from writer's block and they have to persuade people, I write down five Roman numerals: attention, problem, solution, visualization, call to action. Attention means, and I'll just go through them real quick. Attention means, how do I get someone to pay attention quickly? You have a very limited amount of time, like 20 seconds to do that. The problem then is, okay, I need to show that I understand that there's a problem that's meaningful to you that I'm going to fix. Then I present my solution. But what we forget often is a solution is meaningless. A solution is sort of an academic argument. Visualization means, what does the world look like? And to your point earlier, what does my life look like once that solution is in place? So everyone forgets, right? I have a dream as a vision statement. Pass a civil rights bill as a solution. And so those two things are very different. And then finally, if you've got an audience, if they agree with you, if you've shown you can solve the problem, you've given them a better view of the world, call them to action. Make them do something. sign up, donate money, volunteer, you know, text your congressman, whatever it is, but don't waste an audience.
I always tell people you got to put verbs in your sentences and ask people to do something.
By the way, I'm loath to interrupt you, but I love this because in the book I found a quote from President Grant who said, "I am a verb. Leaders are action takers." So I love that you said verbs because I have the speech where Eisenhower apologizes for the D-Day failure. He envisioned if D-Day failed, and he crossed out the line "the troops have been withdrawn" and replaced it with "I have withdrawn the troops, and the decision is mine alone." And he underlines it. And it just reminds us, right? Leaders are action takers.
Yeah, exactly.
Our landings in the Cherbourg Havre area have failed to gain a satisfactory foothold, and I have withdrawn the troops. My decision to attack at this time and place was based on the best information available. The troops, the air, and the Navy did all that bravery and devotion to duty could do. If any blame or fault attaches to the attempt, it is mine alone.
The first page of a book never tells the full story. And those news alerts and headlines, like the ones we get on our phones, don't even scratch the surface of what the story is really all about. Stories are like people, multi-layered and complex. It takes some digging to find the truth, but when we find it, it can change our world. We like to dig. The news on Merritt Street. Essential television.
Lauren, we are sisters.
That's true.
And we host a celebrity-obsessed podcast called Pop Apologists.
We also love Taylor Swift. Chandler, how are you managing to cope while we await Taylor's new album?
Look, I want to be put into a medically induced coma and wake up on April 19th, but I'm not sure my insurance is going to cover it.
Join us on our pop culture podcast, Pop Apologists, where we will be dishing on all things celebrity news and deep diving every word and note of Taylor's new album.
Pop Apologists.
Pop Apologists.
We have something in psychology about the dead man rule. Don't ever give somebody an assignment that a dead man can do, which is nothing. Like they say, don't do this anymore. A dead man can do nothing. Give somebody something to do that's action-oriented.
I fully intend to steal that, so thank you.
You absolutely should, because it resonates with people for sure. You talked about getting people's attention. And look, I don't care if it's at Sunday school or if you're talking to the school board or you're running for office, you really have to get people's attention right up front in a speech, or you're going to be talking to yourself within the first minute or two. What are some good ways that you've used to get people's attention right up front?
Yeah, this is one of the reasons people love TED Talks, is because there's something TED Talks don't do. So I'm violating your dead man rule. But one thing you don't do is you don't stop and thank everyone at the beginning. If you thank everyone at the beginning, you've wasted your time. If you need to thank them, get their attention first, then take a pause and thank them. And so the things that the best speeches do, jokes work to get attention, stories work to get attention, and bold or counterintuitive statements work to get attention. You know, a speech that says, "I'm here to talk about your health, and if you listen to me for the next 15 minutes, I'm going to add 2 years to your life." All of a sudden, the audience says, "Well, I got to stick around for this." So those are three kind of relatively straightforward techniques that get attention.
You work a lot with comedy. That's really important to diffuse people's defensiveness, to open them up, to say, okay, you know, let's loosen up and go with this a little bit. How did you get focused on the comedy aspect?
Well, I used to, in Washington, there are a bunch of these dinners where politicians have to get up and be funny. And so I've worked for a lot of these serious people who then say, oh, now it's funny time. And they almost shift their brains and say, okay, I'm going to gather a group of folks on my team. We're going to write some jokes. And for me, I've always said, no, funny time isn't just for funny time. You know, jokes are really, really useful tools to deliver messages because they're memorable and they diffuse the audience. And I'll give you an old example back when I worked for Al Gore. You know, George W. Bush was running against Al Gore. Al Gore was calling all George W. Bush's plans risky schemes. He was saying it over and over, risky schemes, risky schemes. And in his convention speech, George W. Bush said, you know, if Al Gore had been there at the moon launch, it would be a risky anti-gravity scheme. If he had been there when the light bulb was invented, it would be a risky anti-candle scheme. And it was so effective because instead of saying Al Gore's a liar, Al Gore's an exaggerator, Al Gore's an alarmist, he got everyone to laugh, including Al Gore. And Al Gore stopped saying risky scheme. You know, so joke is a really useful tool. But yes, yeah, so it started as trying to do doing Washington funny and then trying to evolve into something that more closely looked like actual funny. And those two things are not always the same.
Yeah, sometimes it can be too inside baseball, right? It can be something that you got to be an insider to get versus what people can understand and relate to.
And there's something people always get, and it's the only form of humor that is pretty much 100% safe, which is making fun of yourself, self-deprecating humor. And as you know better than anyone, the psychology of that is when you're the speaker, you're kind of elevated slightly above the audience. But by bringing yourself down a little bit, you show that you can laugh at yourself and you put yourself closer to the audience's level. And that really helps you connect as well.
Have you worked with people that have a hard time doing that?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it's funny, some of the most powerful people, right? So being self-deprecating takes a slightly thicker skin. You need to be able to see the humor in yourself. And I won't name names, but there are people who I've been very surprised who just simply weren't ready or able to poke fun at themselves. And that's always stuck with me.
It always worries me if somebody can't take a joke and they can't make a joke about themselves. You wonder what really is going on with them. I've been on Jimmy Kimmel many times, and one of the things that he has us do sometimes are read mean tweets.
I love it.
Sent us stuff. I can tell you, I mean, I've got one that said, "Why don't you just shut up, you bald-headed hillbilly? Come on, I mean, that's funny. I don't care who you are."
I couldn't agree more. I could not agree more. And now there's some jokes people aren't ready to tell. But yes, I agree. Like, if you can't laugh at yourself, it's a little worrisome.
Yeah, and there's a difference between mean-spirited humor and humor that really is meant to be funny, be a joke that everybody can laugh with.
Yeah, and mean-spirited, right, is kind of if you punch down, if you're joking about someone who has less power than you, if someone whose position is less secure. So self-deprecating is safe because you're punching yourself, and then you can always punch up to telling jokes about powerful people is fair game as well.
Now, you wrote for President Biden when—
I did.
He was vice president to begin with.
Yeah, and then as president. I just left the White House, actually.
When you first started writing for him, was he open to it?
So this is a really interesting story. I was assigned to him. I was working for then-Senator Obama at that convention in 2008. And Obama basically said to me, his team said to me, "We need you to write for whoever our vice presidential pick is going to be." And when it was Biden, I introduced myself. I hadn't known him, even though I'd worked in the Senate. He crossed himself, he looked skyward, and he said, "I've been in the Senate longer than you've been alive. What are you going to teach me?" So skepticism, to put it mildly. And so what he actually had me do was I worked with his son, Beau, who has since passed away, on Beau's speech introducing Joe Biden at the convention. And so Biden sat in the room, watched me and Beau work together. And when that, and he was going through his briefing materials and he was half paying attention, but when that speech became a really powerful moment at the convention, that was when President Biden, then Senator Biden, finally said, "Okay, you can roll with me." So he really had me audition by working with his son.
And that was a very powerful speech.
Yeah, it's only 6.5 minutes long, and it remains one of the speeches I'm proudest of having worked on. And again, we're talking politics a little, and the book isn't particularly political. But part of what worked in that speech is something that can work for a lot of people, is we took all of Joe Biden's liabilities or perceived liabilities and showed how they could actually be shows of strength. So the son said, "People say my dad talks too much, but even that's a tale of overcoming. You know, it talked about his stutter, and now he speaks with a strong, clear voice." And so we took everything that could have been a criticism and turned it into sort of an emotional story of overcoming. And I think that's part of why that speech was pretty effective. Writing for President Biden, I describe it like being a session musician in a band that's released 20 albums. You know, it's like people are less interested in hearing my new track, and it's more about, all right, how are we gonna remaster this track and apply it to today's circumstances.
Right. What's he like to work with as president?
He's again, put politics aside, he's just a decent human being. He is just wonderfully decent. There was a night when we ended up working late, and he looked at me and he said, like, where are your kids? And I was like, oh, they're home alone. They're okay. And he's just like, well, let's FaceTime them, you know? And so he wanted to FaceTime to check in on my kids. And that's the personal side. The presidential side is, I think one of the things he does that's really, again, kind of a useful way for all of us to think is, you know, every day is an opportunity to kind of write a new chapter in his own story. And so he's quite certain about what he wants to do and what he wants to achieve and who he's there for and what he wants America to look like. And obviously, anyone who's followed politics knows that it's not easy to achieve that. But just the kind of the certainty of, you know, who the working families are that he grew up with, what the challenges are in their lives, what he can do to alleviate them. It's really purposeful. And I'll just say one other thing is, you know, he went around the room once with all of his advisors and said, how many of you have 529 accounts, right? Which are college savings accounts for your kids. And everyone raised their hands. And he said, that's why you guys don't get it. You're in a lucky place where you get to be able to put aside money for your kids. That's not where most Americans are. So he often describes himself, he sort of holds up his fingers and says, I'm a fingertip politician. He prides himself on kind of having his finger a little bit on the pulse of what families are struggling with.
I think that's what people are really trying to find right now, is somebody that gets the walk they're walking, the challenges that they're facing. And
absolutely.
A lot of the speeches you talk about in the book are historical. You talk about having multiple speeches that fit the moment. And you even talk about the speech that was given by Martin Luther King. He was there, and John Lewis was there in August of 1963. Talk about that a little bit and what you found when you dug into that research-wise.
Yeah, so this is the first chapter in the book, and I talk about Martin Luther King and John Lewis at that famous March on Washington, and neither of them quite gave the speech they wanted to give. John Lewis, for those who don't know, was at the time very young. He was in his 20s. He was leading a group called the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. This was kind of the activist group in the civil rights movement. And he almost didn't want to speak. He basically said, this whole event is too, you know, it's the old guys, it's powerful, it's labor unions, it's not activist. They're calling it a march. They're calling it a march on Washington. It feels more like a march in Washington. And his advisor said, okay, but you gotta talk. And he said, okay, but if I do, I'm gonna put some sting into it, some sting. And boy, did he ever. His draft had lines like, we're gonna march through the South, through the heart of Dixie, the way Sherman did. We're gonna pursue our own scorched earth policy and burn Jim Crow to the ground. He called patience a dirty and nasty word. He said he couldn't support Kennedy's civil rights bill. And this caused an absolute uproar. The march was really very delicate. There were a lot of different speakers. There were a lot of different people who had to be satisfied. Most importantly, President Kennedy, who wanted to be supportive of the civil rights movement, but was kind of back and forth on it. He was late to that game. And so here comes Lewis in his mid-20s, and he just wants to give a stinging, fiery speech. And the night before, his draft started circulating, and people freaked out. And part of why I put this chapter first is one of my jobs has been helping oversee speech writing at conventions, Democratic convention, business conventions. Right. And it is so hard, even when everyone is nominally on the same page, to recognize that people have their own agendas. And John Lewis's agenda was the young person's agenda. And so everyone begged him, John, please change your remarks. Please change your remarks. Martin Luther King went to John Lewis and said, John, this doesn't sound like you. And Lewis said, yeah, but it sounds like us. You know, it sounds like the young people. And so finally what happened is A. Philip Randolph, who was kind of the grandfather of the movement, basically begged Lewis with tears in his eyes. And Lewis said, How could I say no? Saying no to A. Philip Randolph would be like saying no to Mother Teresa. And so in the book, I found this amazing photo of John Lewis kind of retreating at the March on Washington, and he's sitting under Abraham Lincoln's arm in the Lincoln Memorial, furiously rewriting his speech to make it okay for A. Philip Randolph. And so what I say in this chapter, and by the way, each chapter is not just about the undelivered speech, it's about the drama of that moment, the back and forth, why things went one way or the other. And what I say in that chapter is, you know, what if people, instead of hearing about the dream, heard about the nightmare? Because John Lewis wanted to tell him about the nightmare. And Dr. King didn't really want to tell him about the dream. He had given a version of the I Have a Dream speech hundreds of times before the March on Washington. And his advisors wanted him to give a much stronger speech that they called Normalcy Never Again. In other words, America is never going to return to normalcy. This is our new normal. Like, deal with it. And at the end of his speech, King later said, the toughest part about giving a speech is like you're flying around in circles and you don't know where to land. And he didn't know where to land. And so he sort of cut off the end of his prepared remarks and decided he was going to land with this I Have a Dream riff that he had done many times before. And so afterwards, King's advisors were kind of frustrated. They felt like he had done sort of a warmed over greatest hits album. And I remind speakers when I talk to them that it's the 100th time you say the exact same thing that people finally listen. So King didn't want to tell him about the dream. John Lewis wanted to tell him about the nightmare. And if each of them had had their way, it would have been a very, very different march.
Yeah. It's interesting that one thing is planned, another thing is done, and then that clearly has got to be on the short list of the most famous, moving, memorable speeches ever given. Would you agree?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And it's funny, Bjorn, because it almost didn't happen.
And before we talk about some of the others, I'm curious what you think about writing today versus writing even 10 years ago. I think at universities, when I went to school originally in the late 60s, the idea was that a university was a place where you were exposed to differing viewpoints. You were hungry for differing viewpoints. You wanted people to come to campus that didn't think like you, so you could be exposed, you could listen, you could learn, you could challenge. And now, instead of that, it seems like a lot of universities are excluding people of a different mindset. A material percentage of students in a survey recently said they thought it was okay to yell down a speaker that had a different point of view than you. They object, they complain, they petition to exclude speakers that don't think like them. Is writing today more delicate than it was then, or is it still the same challenge?
It's different. And I would, the way I have seen it is that even 10 years ago, and then certainly 50 years ago and 100 years ago, if you look at speeches, Lincoln-Douglas debates, FDR fireside chats, speakers were speaking to a broad audience, people who supported them and people who didn't support them. And so these speeches, when you look back, they spend much more time explaining. Here's why I believe this. Here's the evidence I want to marshal in support of this. Now, I find that speakers are much less likely to be speaking to broad audiences, and they're often speaking only to their audience, to their supporters. And so to me, the evolution has been from explanation to activation. And so speakers right now more often are devoting their energies to activating the people who already support them, as opposed to explaining and working to persuade people who might be neutral or who might not support them. And so that's the change I've seen. And I think something is really lost in that, because I think more time spent by everyone trying to explain why they feel some way is time well spent.
Do you surrender to that as a speechwriter? We know confirmation bias is a real thing. We know that if you present compelling evidence to people suffering from confirmation bias, it actually causes them to deepen their bias, not change their bias. So do you actually say, look, there's no point in that. We need to activate the base. We need to mobilize the people that believe in what we believe in. If it's a corporation wanting to do a particular marketing strategy, if it's a politician wanting to move a certain policy forward, or whatever, do you just try to activate the base and accept the fact that you're not going to persuade people on the other side? What do you do as a speechwriter now?
Yeah, it's a couple things. One is you certainly, there is a temptation to say, look, I'm just going to talk to the people who are open to hearing me. The other thing is we often look for unlikely allies, unlikely advocates, people who you would not expect, because the only way that I've seen evidence to overcome that confirmation bias, and exactly what you cited, is really, it's really challenging, right? You present someone with evidence that conflicts with their views and it doesn't get them to change their mind, they dig in. But one thing that does seem to work a little bit is if you can find someone who can take that person who has conflicting views on a journey, that someone who has gone on a similar journey as them, you know, whether it's a former special forces soldier talking about their journey on guns, examples like this, where you meet people where they are and you don't mock them for believing something different. You don't look down on them. You basically say, I get it. I get why you believe this. But, you know, there are lots of people who shared that view and they've changed over time, and sort of giving people permission to change. So you try to do that. But if I'm being honest, you don't spend all your time doing that. You try to do it because it's the right thing to do, and it's persuasive. It can be persuasive, but you're really, ultimately, it's almost a victory these days if people who disagree, if you just get them to feel a little less negative about the speaker personally. That may be as far as you're able to go.
If you're talking to somebody that you know is a group that you know is pretty dug in, do you think there's value to someone that's giving a speech to say, recognize the fact that you may be suffering from confirmation bias, that you may be so entrenched that you've shut the data window, so you're not processing anything anymore, but you're different than that. You can be better than that. I'm challenging you to hear differently than that. I mean, do you think people respond to that?
A little bit. People do respond to challenges. I think people don't like people, you know, just sort of, you know, feeding them happy talk. So I think challenging the audiences is good. And I do think people respond to that. And I go back to, you know, it's funny to professionally do something that you could have done with a quill and ink or a chisel and granite. But I go back to this Aristotle idea that the whole idea of logos and pathos and ethos is to get people to see, to understand what strings are being pulled when you hear someone speaking to you, right? The original fear about speech writing was that it was some form of dark magic, that just by your words, you could get people to march into battle or hopefully change their minds. And so I think when you show people how their strings are being pulled, it does help them to take a step back. But again, you got to de-emotionalize these moments, because one of the things when we talk about story is more powerful than data. Story is more powerful than fact all the time. And we often say we are thinking animals with feelings, but we're really feeling animals who occasionally think. And so that's one of the big challenges.
Oh boy, I couldn't agree more from a psychological standpoint. In the litigation work I did, it was almost always defense, which meant we went second in front of the jury because the plaintiff got to go first. And I always would counsel the lawyers to say, you've got to deal with the fact that primacy is key. I mean, whoever tells their story first, they're writing on a blank slate. Now, you got to come in and erase all that. I used to tell them, you know, ask the jury, growing up as kids, how many of you were ever running around barefooted? You know, you get a lot of people say, yes. How many of you in the summer would get out barefooted and you'd start across an asphalt highway in August and you get about halfway across and realize, oh my God, my feet are on fire. And everybody would raise their hand and say, oh yeah, it happened. What did you do? Well, you either ran across real fast or you turned around and went back, but you didn't stay there and burst into flame. Pain is a motivator. You've been told this story and nobody likes conflict, so you ran to one side or the other. Now, my job is I've got to get you to come back out on that hot highway and come all the way back across to the other side. And you are loath to do that. You are not going to want to do that, but you got to give me a shot here. And it was amazing how you would start seeing people. A, they would laugh, and then they would kind of nod, and then say, okay, so let's go back. You broke the lamp. Your brother beat you to your mother to tell you that it wasn't them. So you didn't get there first. I'm that second kid. You got to give me a shot. And it was amazing. If people would laugh a little bit, they would listen. Even if it was a murder trial, no matter what, they could laugh in a murder trial and give you a shot.
Yeah, absolutely. And by the way, laughter is almost more important in serious moments. You know, Abraham Lincoln at the height of the Civil War, you know, cracked jokes in cabinet meetings. And when no one laughed, he said, gentlemen, why don't you laugh? Like, you need this medicine as much as I do. But you reminded me of something I didn't say in the previous answer, which is there's one other thing you can do when someone really disagrees with you is find an area of agreement. If you are able to give even the tiniest, throw the tiniest bone to the person who disagrees with you. And in courtroom, you're probably not going to throw a bone to the prosecution. But if you can find a little area where you can say, you know, you said this, and I agree with you 100% there. Now, I take that agreement and I go in a slightly different direction. But that gains you a ton of credibility because you show that you're willing to be open-minded, and it helps them sort of open their mind a little bit as well. But I love the hot asphalt.
Yeah, it's something everybody could relate to. And I also agree with what you just said. We called it modified mea culpa. You can throw them a bone on something that's not actionable.
Exactly. Exactly.
You can agree with them on something that's not going to be on the jury charge, that is not an element of the crime. Agree with them on all of that, but don't agree with them on anything that's going to be asked in the jury room.
Yep. Totally agree. Totally agree.
You can buy a lot of credibility with stuff that doesn't matter.
Yep.
Talk about President Nixon's resignation. Did he actually write a speech refusing to resign that he never gave?
He did. And so this in this chapter, you know, people, when they think of Nixon right now, he's almost become kind of like a cartoonish figure, like a sort of sweaty, you know, dark stubble looking kind of evil. But we forget the guy was charming. He was persuasive. And early in his career, he was in real trouble. He was in danger of being thrown off the ticket for Eisenhower. He was running for vice president. And he gave a famous speech that's now called the Checkers speech, where he basically said he was being accused of kind of a campaign slush fund, which at the time was scandalous and now is basically legal. And he basically did what people called a financial striptease. He basically laid his life bare to everyone. He said, this is how much money we have. This is how much I inherited. This is how much I earn. My wife can't afford a fur coat, but she has a respectable Republican cloth coat, and finally said, and there is one gift we got, and it's this dog, Checkers. And I'm sorry, the kids love him, and we're not returning him. And it was the most incredibly charming speech. And it really began this era of politicians being relatable and confessional in a way. And it was so effective that hundreds of thousands of people wrote to the Republican National Committee, even though Nixon forgot to tell them to write to the Republican National Committee, saying he should stay on the ticket. And so he had saved his own political backside once by giving a speech. And when in the midst of impeachment, he thought, maybe I can pull another rabbit out of this hat. Maybe I can do it again. And so he was prepared to do something quite similar. He was prepared to say, look, I've seen the evidence against me. It ain't good. It isn't good. But here's why I think I should stay as president. And he put together an argument with Ray Price, who was his speechwriter at the time, where he basically said, we've had a president assassinated, JFK. We've had a president basically run out of office, Lyndon Johnson. Don't we need, for national continuity, me to stay on, especially because the evidence you see against me, again, it looks bad, but in reality, it isn't that bad. And so Nixon looked at it and he absolutely considered it and thought maybe he could be persuasive enough.
Whatever the mistakes that have been made, and they are many, and whatever the measure of my own responsibility for those mistakes, I firmly believe that I have not committed any act of commission or omission that justifies removing a duly elected president from office. If I did believe that I had committed such an act, I would have resigned long ago. For me to see this through will have costs for the country in the short run. The months ahead will not be easy for any of us. But in the long run, whatever the outcome, the results will be a more stable form of government. Far more damaging than the ordeal of a Senate trial, far more damaging than even the conviction and removal of a president, would be the descent toward chaos if presidents could be removed short of impeachment and trial. Throughout the Western world, governmental instability has reached almost epidemic proportions. In the United States, within the last dozen years, one president was assassinated. The next was, in effect, driven from office when he did not even seek re-election. And now the third stands on the verge of impeachment by the House of Representatives, confronted with calls for his resignation in order to make the process of removal easy. This country bears enormous responsibilities to itself and to the world. If we are to meet those responsibilities in this and future presidencies, we must not let this office be destroyed, or let it fall such easy prey to those who would exult in the breaking of the president that the game becomes a national habit.
What I find interesting about this chapter is throughout our history, we've had leaders who have tried to hang on to power even when it was time to go. Rudy Giuliani, after September 11th, made a very similar argument about staying on as mayor of New York, saying, look, just for continuity in this moment of upheaval. And so Nixon considered it and he considered it, but ultimately he decided not to do it. And I have one other chapter where a speaker decided not to give a speech. And this is the mayor of Boston, a guy named Kevin White in the 1970s. Boston had a terrible busing crisis. It wasn't just the South. A federal judge had ordered him to integrate Boston city schools. And there was violence, and it was just a terrible chapter in Boston's history. People were injured. And ultimately, he had prepared a speech saying, I'm not going to do it. I'm not integrating the schools. That's it. And ultimately, he decided to back down too, because one of his advisors told me as I was doing research for the book, there's something worse than telling people something they don't want to hear. And that's telling them something they do want to hear and then not being able to follow through on it. Right. And so Nixon kind of knew that he couldn't follow through on this fight to stay in office. So if he laid out all the reasons he should stay and then had to resign or was impeached, that would be worse than just resigning. And Mayor Kevin White in Boston basically told people something they didn't want to hear. And amazingly enough, and he said, look, I don't like it, you don't like it, but those are the rules and we're going to do it. And he won re-election. And I just want to read one quote from him at that time, which he actually said in the speech, which I think is a good lesson for politicians today. He said, there is no odor save death, worse than that of a public official too frightened and fearful to say above a whisper what he honestly believes. And White basically said, so what this judge is doing, it's the right thing to do. It may not be fun, but it's the rule. We're going to do it. And I just love those examples.
Yeah, that's pretty powerful. It's interesting that you talk about the speech that Nixon never gave, because the one he actually did give was really, it seemed to me, diametrically opposite of the one he didn't give. He didn't give the one saying, it's good for the country if I stay on. And the one he gave was, it's good for the country if I leave. I'm leaving, not because of anything other than it's best for the country.
Right. It's I guess we'd call it a justification in search of a conclusion. You had two different conclusions, same justification.
Yeah, exactly. It was a sacrifice on his part.
Exactly.
Either way. One of the things, because I studied it and lived through it so much just because of the timing in my life, but JFK's involvement with the Bay of Pigs and the Cuban Missile Crisis and all of that. Talk about that speech. That was
This is so dramatic. 1962, October, Kennedy is presented with evidence that there are missile sites in Cuba. And he is immediately told by his military advisors, we got to go in and bomb them. we got to go in and bomb them before they're operational. And so they had put together a plan, 800 airstrikes on Cuba. The Air Force General Curtis LeMay, nicknamed Bombs Away LeMay, you know, he wanted to go right at it. Kennedy divided. He kind of created a group of advisors, and he put Robert Kennedy in charge. And he said, we're actually going to look at two different approaches. One is the airstrike, these airstrikes. One is a naval blockade. And in fact, you're going to present your recommendations to the president in a day and a half or 2 days. And the first thing in your recommendations is going to be a speech explaining to the nation why this is the correct course of action. And I just love that as a speechwriter, because there's this idea, if you can't explain it, maybe it's not the right course of action. So we now, and this is, by the way, in history, is the first use of the term hawks and doves. The airstrike group were the hawks. The blockade group were the Picasso doves, war hawks and Picasso doves. And so there's an airstrike draft explaining airstrikes. And what we didn't know at the time is that the missiles were already operational. So the airstrike would have been an incredibly terrible outcome, because these were nuclear missiles. Command was in the hands of the missile commanders on the ground. They didn't have to call Moscow. But in this speech, there's a parenthetical, a bracketed expression. And this is when people are writing and they don't know what the answers are going to be or what the outcome is going to be. They basically say, to come, we're going to fill in this blank later. And here's what the blank said. It said, follows a description of first reports of action. In other words, in this speech, there's a buildup. We've undertaken these airstrikes, and then they just have a blank. And now we're going to fill in, after it happens, we're going to fill in the blank.
The world can be sure that our choice of rapid, sure, and minimum force was made only after all other alternatives had been most searchingly surveyed. Every other course of action involved risks of delay and of obfuscation, which were wholly unacceptable. And with no prospect of real progress in removing this intolerable communist nuclear intrusion into the Americas. The size, speed, and secrecy of the deployment, the barefaced falsehoods surrounding it, and the newly revealed character of the conspirators involved made plain that no appeal, no warning, no offer would shift them from their course. Prolonged delay would have meant enormously increased danger, and immediate warning would have greatly enlarged the loss of life on all sides. It became my duty to act.
There's this great quote that on your headstone, there's the year you were born and the year you die, and a tiny dash in between. And to God, that tiny dash is everything. Well, in the book, I say to humanity, to history, that parenthetical is everything. What would have happened if we started airstrikes and had, you know, half the Eastern Seaboard vaporized in a nuclear counterattack? And it absolutely could have happened. And it was so harrowing when people found this out that everyone involved with writing the speech denied having written it. So
really,
one of the mysteries within the mystery that I have in the book is I hired an FBI forensic analyst to look at the handwriting to say, whose handwriting is this? Is it McGeorge Bundy, the National Security Advisor? Is it Ted Sorensen, who had been Kennedy's, who was a conscientious objector in World War II and said it was unthinkable, I didn't write it. And so I go in and I solve the mystery, and I won't keep your listeners in suspense. But Ted Sorensen, who denied having written it, actually wrote almost all of it. Others chimed in, and I thought, is it possible? Is he lying? And then I thought about my own experience where I've written, support for use of force resolutions and things like that. And sometimes something, and you know this professionally, sometimes something is so hard to confront that you've done it, that you really do forget. And I believe that Sorensen believed what he said when he said he didn't write it. But it's one of these incredible moments in history.
This is one of the reasons I think, it's just one of several reasons I'm going to talk about before we're done that I think people need to read Undelivered, because I think there are so many things that have happened in history behind the scenes that people don't know. And realizing how close we were to actual nuclear attack just based on the decision. This wasn't like, wow, this was a long shot that this could have happened. This wasn't a long shot at all. This was just as likely to have gone this direction as the blockade. I think people are going to be astounded at some of this. And I think also the lessons in here about life and finding the courage to stand up and have a voice and own that and not be a passive follower and speak your mind in a thoughtful way. This is a powerful book, Jeff, and I think you've done an amazing job in pulling this together, I just have to say.
Well, thanks for saying that. And that's one of the things, someone asked me what the theme of the book is. And initially I said, well, I don't know that there's a theme. It's 15 interesting chapters in history. And then I thought, well, actually, as you look at them, there is a theme. And the theme is using the position you have to make the difference that you can make all the difference for a community, a company, a country, the world. You know, history doesn't happen, right? We say history, we sort of think history happened the way it happened because that's the way it had to happen. And what this book says is absolutely not. It's the decisions people of conscience and bravery make every day. That's what makes history. And everyone has that power.
Right. I think one of the things that really jumped out to me about it is I think people look at the way history treats leaders. We look at these people as though they're some way bigger than life and they have some vision that shows them outcomes that we can't see. And I think people sometimes think that they're less than because they're conflicted, because they don't see a clear path at the time. And they would think, well, this should be clear to me. It isn't always clear to these leaders. They are conflicted down to the minute they step up to the mic. Sometimes they don't know which speech or which paragraph or whether to read what's in the parentheses or not. They're fallible just like everyone else. It's not like they've got some special code that gives them the outcome before anybody else knows it. Everybody has those conflicts.
Absolutely. And I think one of the examples of that I love in this book is Dwight Eisenhower at, you know, right before D-Day. And he did this before every engagement in battle. He wrote an apology. He basically imagined, what if D-Day goes the other way? What if it fails? And he apparently, this was one of the things he did. He would do it before every engagement battle. He'd fold it up, put it in his wallet. Things went well. He'd tear it up, throw it in the trash can. This one, D-Day, he kept in his wallet for weeks and weeks, found it later, tossed it in the trash can. His personal aide said, no, this one's probably a keeper. But this idea, later on, years later, he was asked about this failure speech. And he said, what was I going to do? Hide from it? You know, I had planned this thing. I had set it in motion. Success or failure, that was going to be on me. And there'd be no sense trying to hide from it. So I planned everything. I hoped for the best. But I also was prepared to accept the worst because I still thought it was the right thing to do. And so it's a very, very short speech. But it is such a perfect lesson in the language of leadership, of responsibility taking, and of confidence.
Yeah, when I was doing press readiness with CEOs, for example, just to get away from politics for a minute, I always told them, don't get CEO-itis where you feel like you have to know the answer to everything. You don't. But you can say, as a leader, I don't know why they did that. And I'm not sure exactly what the process was, but I can tell you, I didn't do it, but I support the people who did. I'm the leader. I didn't do it, but I support the people who did. I hired them. They work for me. I stand behind them. I didn't do it, but I support those who did. Leaders have to step up. And I think one of the themes of this book was that these people were fallible. They did have multiple speeches. They did have doubts. They weren't sure, but they still took action.
And the one thing I'll add to that, I love your example of counseling CEOs, is I often think it's really important for leaders to say the thing that only they can say. In other words, what is their connection with this? I had a boss who used to say, you know, if someone started spouting something that sounded like it was written by a lawyer or sounded like it was written by someone else, they would say, blue suit, red tie, here to lie. And I always say, you don't want to be blue suit, red tie, here to lie. Think about how you actually react as a person before you start thinking about your position. And so that I think I would, if I add to your CEO advice, I think that those things in combination are very important and very powerful.
It's funny, I've watched juries time and again respond to them taking ownership, to saying, I don't know, but then owning what they do know and being human beings about it. People know the truth when they hear it.
Absolutely.
I've believed that for a long, long time. We're at a different phase. And 2 years ago, I had never even heard the word Zoom. And now we've got people in corporate America, in politics, in all different walks of life that are having to deliver what are intended to be powerful messages to a little dot on their computer.
Yeah.
They can't even look at the screen to see the gallery of people because then they're not making eye contact. They've got to look at the little camera to the side. What's the impact of this? And do you think we're ever going to get back to the real eye contact, personal interaction that we ever saw?
I love this question because I had to help oversee speech writing for the first national political convention that was totally on Zoom. And this was the 2020 political convention. And one of the things we found out very quickly is 5 minutes is a long time. You know, there were more 3 and 2 minute speeches than there had ever been before. The idea of 10 or 12 minutes face to camera, really, really difficult. The other thing you realize is it's not only the words that matter. Location sends a message. Backdrop sends a message. You get to be a little bit of a cinematographer, right? We joke about all of our curated backdrops, but you know, here I put a book over my shoulder, you know, hoping people say, oh, that's what the cover looks like. But it is really, really tough to hold an audience on a screen. And it's a skill. And so we found shorter is better. You know, much more direct, much more produced. Don't use words to say everything. You know, use examples. The most memorable part of the convention was when we did the 50 state roll call and the camera went to every different state. In Rhode Island, you had a guy holding, you know, a plate of calamari. You know, it's like, you know, show something. If the goal of a speech is to persuade by being a person who sort of has enough personality to be persuasive, you know, in Zoom, you can find other ways to do a little bit of that work that the words don't need to carry everything.
You make a point in the book about this, and it is true that we tend to talk at about, I don't know, 120, 130 words a minute. I say my wife has gussed up to about 160 sometimes. but when you don't have the room, and you don't have noise, and you don't have applause, and you don't have reactions, you can cover a lot more verbal ground in a minute than you can otherwise. If you're just talking to a camera without all of that feedback and noise, you can get up to, well, you say in the book, 150, 60, 70 words a minute. So you can get a lot more said in less time.
You can, although I will say there's no substitute for that feedback, for the energy in the room. And so this gets back to your original question, like, are we going to go back to in person? I think in many ways we are. I just took my daughters to a concert the other night and they were blown away, you know, and they said, like, the energy, it's not just the music, right? It's the energy. And so, you know, a lot of when we gather to speak to each other, to rally together, yeah, it's the words, but also it's that feeling of common cause. And I think that's one of the things we're craving and getting back to a little bit.
Yeah, I just finished my 20th season, and year before last, I did 175 shows with no audience. I was just talking to a camera in a big studio, and I felt like a really crummy performer at a Holiday Inn on a Sunday night. You know, there's like two tables out there with old people that can't hear me. There was no energy. It was terrible.
It's weird. And I think about, you know, I think, you know, President Biden for the first year of his presidency, just talking to a camera and, you know, you want the energy, you need the energy. You want to see what's landing. You want to see what's reacting. I had a chance to work on a big comedy show at the Kennedy Center in Washington, D.C. And, I can share his name, like Steve Martin was up there and he was practicing on stage and the arena was empty and he kept working his material till he could hear like the ushers and custodians laugh. You know, there were maybe five people in the room, but he needed to know where he was getting his laughs, even if it was only five people. So the idea of doing that to an empty room, you know, the real pros, they want to know where their beats are, where they can breathe, where they build energy.
Yeah. There's some called, as you know, minimal encouragers, where the people are nodding, they're making eye contact, they're giving you feedback that, okay, you can move on. Got that point, gotcha, or don't have it. You know, if they're looking at you like a dead trout, then you know, okay, you haven't landed. You got to make this point again until they get it, because you don't have a link in the chain until they get this one. And if you don't have that feedback, you're lost.
Yeah, and the really good speakers are looking for that minimal encouragement. They're feeding off it.
It's so important because it's like a compass. How important are sound bites when you write a speech for somebody? Are there three or four things you hope land and get picked up?
Yes, absolutely. And I divide sound bites from sound barks, right? Like on Twitter, we see snarky one-liners that are kind of mean and get a laugh. That's not to me a sound bite. A sound bite is when you actually summarize an entire argument in a really memorable way. And I feel like I'm doing a lot of like old timey stuff, but right, like famous one, Julius Caesar, "I came, I saw, I conquered," right? He had a lot more to say about the sacking of the city of Zella in 76 BC. But if all you hear is that, you got the message, you know what happened. And so a good soundbite really does summarize an argument in a memorable way. And so especially now in the age of Twitter, and by the way, a soundbite used to be about 47 seconds on the evening news in the 1960s. Yeah. By the 80s, it was like 9 seconds. Now it's probably 5 seconds or 280 characters if you're on Twitter. So soundbites are more and more compressed, but you still want a way to find a way to memorably summarize the entirety of your argument.
Yeah. And if it's something that people can repeat, if it's something they can use in a sentence, if it's something that they can say for you again to somebody else, it's so important. And I think soundbites get a bad rap because if it's elegant, if it's succinct, the fact that it alliterates and can be said quickly shouldn't really demean how important it is. If you've thought about it and it's a good way to say it, that's a good thing.
Yeah, you are so right. People who wrote for President Clinton used to joke that if you gave him the soundbite, "That's the way the cookie crumbles," he would say, like, "That's how the baked confection falls apart." Like, he was so allergic to soundbites. But I'm with you. I don't think, you know, I think some people think because they're catchy, there's something intellectually dishonest about them. I could not disagree more. I think giving your audience a way to summarize your argument in a way that they remember and they can repeat, it is exactly, that's exactly what you want to do. And so, you know, I'm always looking for a soundbite.
Just because you can put it on a bumper sticker doesn't mean it's wrong.
That's exactly right. Exactly right.
That's for sure. So what's next for you? What are you working on now?
So one of the things when I wrote this book, there were a couple speeches I couldn't find. You know, they're really interesting ones. Condoleezza Rice was about to give a speech on September 11th about missile defense. That one's still classified. I know where it is, but there were some that I knew were out there and I couldn't find. And so I sort of hoped that having this book undelivered out there and people knowing, oh, wow, there's a place for these interesting undelivered speeches. I hope some would come out of the woodwork, and some already have. One of former Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld's guys emailed me and said, remember when Donald Rumsfeld talked about the known knowns and unknown unknowns in Iraq? Well, believe it or not, we had speeches written for several of those different outcomes. And so I'm going to keep updating and keep writing. I'm continuing to help out some clients, business leaders, actors, athletes, celebrities with their speeches. And I'm doing something I have not done in 25 years, which is I'm taking a little bit of a vacation and figuring out what's next.
Well, let me tell you, when I went through everything that you've been doing over these last 25 years, I can attest you damn sure deserve some time off, because you have been working with both hands and burning the candle at both ends. That's for sure.
Yeah. Well, I had more hair when I started too. So, you know, I'm feeling it.
Yeah. I feel your pain on that. Trust me.
Yes.
Well, listen, everybody, I want to say again, the book is undelivered. The never heard speeches that would have rewritten history. And we did not talk about them all because I didn't want to just read the book to you. But he talks about Hillary Clinton's acceptance speech. He talks about Emperor Hirohito. I mean, there are so many profound moments in here. But if you don't consider yourself a historian, if you don't consider yourself somebody that they're like, yeah, I don't care what he was going to say, that is not a reason not to read this book. I'm telling you, this book is full of profound information about how you express yourself, how you can talk to your children about expressing themselves, about what's important about getting your message across, how to do that. I think there's so much information in here that when you pick this up, you will not be able to put it down. You will buy 10 copies and give it to people, I promise you. This is a really novel approach to looking at history. And congratulations on this, Jeff. It's a bell ringer.
Well, thanks for saying that. I really appreciate it. And that was indeed my goal, is, you know, not just a what if, but also a bit of a how-to. And so I love that that's one of the things you found there. Thank you for the generosity and the generosity of your time.
Well, I appreciate you coming on, and I hope we can talk again soon.
I would love that.
Jeff, thanks so much.
Thank you.